It's important to wake up in the morning and choose growth. We meet so many executives who say, I want to grow, but then they don't get into the motions and the rhythm to actually grow.
From McKinsey & Company, I'm Sean Brown, and welcome to Inside the Strategy Room. You just heard Jill Zucker, one of our guests today, commenting on the importance of explicitly choosing growth. Today, we're going to discuss six strategies for driving growth outperformance, building on a recent article that Jill and our other guests co-authored on what we're calling courageous growth. Jill is a senior partner and the former managing partner of our New York office. She co-leads our global growth transformation work within our growth marketing and sales practice, and her client work focuses on financial services. Jill, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Sean.
Also joining us is Kate Siegel, a partner in our Detroit office who works with a range of industrial businesses and is focused on growth strategy and execution. Kate, it's great to have you here today.
It's wonderful to be here, John.
And I also want to welcome Rebecca Doherty, a partner in our Bay Area office and the co-leader of our strategic growth and innovation practice. Rebecca, it's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
All right, let's get started. Jill, why don't we start with you? This may seem like a somewhat naive question, but why the focus on growth? Why does it matter so much?
Growth drives performance. It drives culture. It drives employee satisfaction. It helps you retain and keep the best talent and keeps innovation in the marketplace. It's important to grow profitably. Top line only growth tends to catch up with you over time. And so it's when we talk about growth, we mean profitable growth. And we want to talk about the strategies to achieve that. And it's hard.
Got it. So now driving growth seems to be one of the biggest challenges companies face right now. What are you seeing in your client work?
Growth is something that most executives aspire to. I'm hard-pressed to meet a senior executive who doesn't want to grow their company or their business line. And yet we find that growth is quite hard to achieve. Only, 25% of companies grow sustainably over time. We've done research of over 4,000 companies around the globe and really tried to look at what are the things that drive growth for those companies. We found a set of ingredients that are true across industries around the world. And so just to set the backdrop, we recognize the challenges that companies are facing today. And so we don't address growth without acknowledging the challenges in the global economy, what that has done to challenge growth for us over time. And so, this research is done over a period of ebbs and flows in the economy. That said, if you can achieve growth, growth is rewarded. Growth outperformers do get rewarded by total shareholder return, 7 points through our research, and certainly more over time. And so I don't need to convince any of you growth is good, but the math does tell us that growth is both good for companies, good for executives, and certainly importantly, good for our shareholders.
So what are some of the things that you've found that most differentiate these growth outperformers from the rest of their competitors?
The first thing that we found is it's important to wake up in the morning and choose growth. We meet so many executives who say, I want to grow, but then they don't get into the motions and the rhythm to actually grow. They don't allocate resources in a way that supports growth over time. And so there's a set of actions that represent choosing, not just wanting, but really doing these actions to inspire a culture of growth and to achieve growth in your company. Having the courage to make those bold moves, even in a time of economic uncertainty. And so then once you've gotten past that, what does it mean to activate growth? There are three pathways to growth that we talk about. There's one which is expand the core, maximize the value of the assets you have today. Do everything you can to achieve success in the businesses you're in with the assets you have. That's sales effectiveness, marketing ROI. It's all the things to say, take advantage of the position you have today. 80% of growth across industries, across the world, comes from maximizing the value of your core. But it's not enough to help you be in that upper echelon of companies that achieve growth on a sustained basis over time. And the second two categories represent the remaining 20%. Those are move into adjacencies. That is, across the value stream where you play today, are there things to the left or the right of your core where you can actively participate? Are there new geographies where you can move into and repeat what you're doing in the core? And then the third pathway is really about innovation, about breakout businesses, really jumping into new territories beyond what you're doing today.
So you spoke about the need to actively choose growth, but when you're trying to push against heavy economic headwinds, like many companies are facing now, just trying to survive, how do you create the space to also be able to choose growth?
You know, I think over the past decades, one-time events were one-time events. And you could say, we're not going to choose growth in a period of a one-time challenging environment. The problem is the frequency of these one-time events, things that we can't predict, has become so pervasive in all of our businesses that we need to continue to be a courageous growth leader in a through-cycle mindset. And so we looked at the financial crisis of 07 and 08 to say, what really happened for those who were courageous and those who weren't? And in the moment, the gap between those who chose growth and those who stuck to the core was reasonably narrow. You didn't see a lot of upside for those who chose growth. But as the financial crisis evolved and that we came out of it and the economy settled in, the gap between those who chose, who made some bold bets, really widened. And you saw a much steeper curve of growth for those who had made some bold bets. You know, what does it mean, though? It means allocating resources to places you really have conviction are going to grow. It means eliminating the hobbies. It means, you know, being careful in your culture to shut things off without shutting talent off. Just because you have a talented executive who's on what was a good experiment didn't work, that doesn't mean the executive needs to leave. But how do you help bring them back in so you have this culture of fast failure are important elements.
Got it. So once you've identified these pathways to growth, how do you ensure that you're actually able to take them to the destination, if you will?
These are some of the things I started to talk about, laying the foundation for more dynamic resource allocation. This is an important piece of it. And by resource allocation, we mean both capital and talent. You know, we've been through a period where talent was scarce. It remains scarce in many areas in our companies. And so, you know, finding a way to allocate talent to those growth areas is an important piece of this. You know, it's really thinking about your inorganic opportunities as part of a broader strategy, having clarity around what you're going to do in terms of executing on inorganic opportunities. That's both acquisitions and divestitures, to my point earlier about hobbies. And then it's really about investing in building your functional capabilities. You know, how do you really achieve excellence in whether it's marketing or digital marketing or sales effectiveness or innovation? It's building those capabilities to be a routine part of your business and the system that you're operating in.
Thank you for setting that context for us, Jill. Now, Rebecca, maybe you could talk about some of the specific strategies that your research revealed.
Building on what Jill said, right, we really dug into these three areas, right? Really choosing growth, thinking about all the pathways of growth, and then executing with excellence. And we looked at both the near term in terms of some of the uncertainty over the last 5 years. What are companies really done that have been special to elevate them, as well as a longer term over the last 10, 15 years would have been these timeless truths. And across the board, we found really six differentiating strategies. I'll just call out the three that are timeless, right? This idea that Jill mentioned, where 80% of growth comes from your core. So the core is critical. You must continue to focus there and innovate there and stretch. But at the same time, that's not enough. So going into adjacencies for the other 20%, give or take, is really critical. And if really people are at the heart of what we do, the talent, right? What we see is whether it's kind of the day-to-day growth or the broader transformation, right? Having your core people involved, having the ownership and having the leadership mindset is really critical to driving the success. And then the three items that are kind of unique or kind of new, if you will, to the last 5 years is first this idea around an innovative culture, right? How do growth and innovation come together, and how does innovation really power the profitable growth that you're driving in a company? The second is around sustainability, right? How does sustainability play into the agenda, and how can it be a further accelerant, not a replacement of growth, not a replacement of profitability, but if you already have growth and profitability in place, how sustainability can be that extra punch that gives you lift over your competitors. And then finally, this idea around portfolio allocation and shrinking to grow. You're thinking courageously and boldly, what are bold moves that you can make, even if that means, for example, shutting down or divesting something where you may not be the best owner, but reallocating your resources toward an end that will be more successful.
Thanks, Rebecca. So let's dig deeper into some of these. On the point about innovation, is there something unique about how the best growers innovate?
We ran this survey of over 1,000 companies and executives. And at least I was surprised, frankly, to see that, you know, how at the forefront innovation has come across all our paths of growth. Right. So I think typically, historically, people might think in the core, we're talking about marketing ROI, we're talking about sales effectiveness, really using that to turbocharge our core. But here we see companies looking just as much at innovating new offerings. So when we think about this, it really is combining a lot of the traditional best practice levers, both in the core, in adjacencies and breakout, with some of the more innovative thinking and really thinking about how you permeate that through the company and not just as a one-time thing.
What about sustainability? Many out there might still see investments in sustainability and ESG more broadly as potentially more of a cost than a generator of growth. What's your perspective there?
It's not a substitute for growth. It's not a substitute for profitability. But companies that have really been able to embed sustainability have really been rewarded, perhaps intuitively, right, that those who do growth and profit, so profitable growth, right, leads to 5% points in outperformance in terms of TRS. But what we really see, what I found interesting, is if you have the growth and profit in place, you add ESG into the mix. And this isn't, you know, dabbling on it as a hobby. This is really integrating it core into your strategy, thinking about how you share the messages with investors and really committing, right? And really thinking about ESG in a holistic way. Those that combine that with growth and profit see 7 points of outperformance. And there's many examples out there. You know, we see in some sectors such as retail, where you have brands that have really brought sustainability into the core, have done a string of acquisitions over the years to really drive impact, right? You see other areas such as energy, right, which is very top of mind for many companies, how some companies there have pivoted to actually think more about sustainable sources of energy. Even in industries such as, you know, beer, if you will, the carbonation, the process to make the carbonation in the beer is one that is actually quite energy intensive. And so there are companies out there that have actually innovated to say, hey, is there another way I can bring in that carbonation in a way that's greener?
You talked about the timeless growth strategies. What makes them so timeless? And maybe let's start with reinforcing the core business.
So really, you know, growth begins with the core. You know, timeless and true, very interesting to us, because if you look historically over, you know, 10, 15 years, and you look over the last 5 years, these numbers are actually pretty consistent. Companies really think about allocating their portfolio really across the core and across adjacencies and breakout. What we found is companies that grow in all directions over a 10-year period will have a 2x chance of outperforming. I think the key here is not doing everything at once, but to think about, you know, what are the bold bets you're going to make over a decade? And how do you sequence those? But one of the things that we found is that actually companies that really focus on making one substantial adjacent move in a 5-year period actually do better. It's really about the focus and putting your resources behind, you know, bets that you think will scale. It doesn't mean you don't, you know, plant the seeds for the future in other areas, but, you know, a management team can only focus on so many things at once.
That's great, Rebecca. So how do you balance those bets on breakout growth against the need to continue building the core? You said that 80% of growth typically comes from the core. So do you recommend an 80-20 split toward growth in the core versus growth outside the core?
Yeah, I think it will vary. And so, of course, it depends, right? And part of what will vary is a little bit where is the maturity of the business, right? And where you are. And what I mean by that is, you know, bring it into focus in two ways, right? First is, you know, the S-curve of the business. Is your core business one that is kind of early in the S-curve? And so therefore, you know, you should really focus more there and propel that to kind of really accelerate growth. Or you are at a place where it's like, where it's a mature company, right? It's a mature business. And you're actually there just, you will kind of milking it a bit, right? And making incremental gains, gaining share, you know, becoming stronger. But a lot of maybe the core investment, you know, has been done. The second one is just around, you know, in terms of the focus of the resourcing, right? And yes, obviously the amount matters, but what companies sometimes do is they'll take last year's budget, tweak it by 10%, and voila, you have the new budget. That is actually not what we want to do, right? So what you can think about is for a breakout business, right? Sometimes you actually need just a little bit of seed funding, but it's about putting the right people on it. So we think of resources in terms of money and in terms of people. Maybe you're actually taking your top talent and actually putting it in. I, you know, worked with one company where they took the CTO and actually took them out of the CTO position, put them into the new business to actually think about how to grow that. It wasn't a ton in terms of investment dollars initially, right? But it was a lot in terms of talent. And how do you think about early stage needs? Because there's some bets that you might make where you actually need a ton of capital investment or just, you know, investment up front, but you're not going to get a lot of revenue up front. Right. So what is the arc of the business that you're building? For some of them, you know, you start with smaller investment and it'll grow. Maybe it'll grow somewhat proportionately with revenue. And others, maybe you need a big capital outlay in the beginning to set the foundation for growth for later. And I think all the profiles can work. I think what's really important is to have a really sound business plan, right? And to understand what the milestones are, both operationally and financially. And also, you know, frankly, be willing to pull the plug if it's not panning out. Right, which is often a very bold move and hard to do in itself.
Indeed, it can be. So, Rebecca, I get that the reallocation of resources includes both people and capital, but people tend to have a lot of different motivation drivers. How do you keep motivation high when you're moving somebody from, say, leading a stable, high-performing core side of the business into what might end up being a much riskier pursuit of a breakout growth strategy? And if that new venture doesn't succeed, how do you keep that executive excited for whatever role they end up taking on next?
Thank you, Sean. I think that's a great question. And it ties a bit to what Jill said earlier, right? Around, hey, failed business is not a failed executive. And I think a lot of that has to do with the culture you put in place. The culture also needs to reward risk taking. Each company, though, needs to figure out its own risk tolerance. And frankly, the people that you put it, right? So in that example that you gave, you know, there are some executives who are probably better suited for something that is more steady state, that is a little bit less risk-taking and is more incremental, but is frankly very strong for the business, right? And there's other executives which maybe have more of a DNA to be able to do this. And you see this also in, you know, beyond the company, right? Those that go into startups versus those that go to a Fortune 500 company, you know, the skill sets are a little different, right? And I think in terms of incentives, you know, what's the balance where you can align an executive's, one individual contributors, frankly, right? Incentives to delivering the project, but also still have incentive to think, you know, what's the best for the broader company.
On the far end of the spectrum, we see management teams that are awarded uniformly on, you know, EPS growth of the business, total shareholder return to the business. And therefore, you know, whether you're in the innovation wing or you're in, you know, maintaining and maximizing the core, you're rewarded equally. And that allows for a much more fluent conversation across executives to say, you know, it's not about giving me more money than the person to my left or to my right, but it's about what's going to grow the total shareholder return overall. And therefore, I'm okay giving up some of the capital that would otherwise go to me to go to this innovation because we all believe that it's going to be the best for the growth of the company. And so certainly, you know, that doesn't always work all the way down, cascaded through the organization. But at the CEO's table, we've seen companies move in that direction.
Awesome. Thank you. Let's move now to growth through adjacencies. Kate, do you want to take us through that?
Okay, let's do that. So in adjacencies, right, 80% is in your core, but where does the other 20% come from? It is in adjacencies and breakout business pathways. And we know that finding and prioritizing growth outside your core is really challenging. And we've looked at over 250 companies that had announced significant adjacency moves over the last 20 years. And what we found is there were four types of logics that they were using to underpin these breakout or adjacent moves. The first was, you know, their customers. These adjacent moves use relationships or knowledge of their customers' pain points. Capability. Could they use some of their existing assets, people, talent, or processes to this new market better than any other company? Value chain, going up or downstream to capture various synergies along the way. Or they had an idea around disruption in business model innovation. Could they have a new monetization model that would leverage some of these other assets I described, or a disruptive technology that they thought could just deliver distinctive value propositions to various customers? And what's interesting is the more logics that were used, the higher the reward. So outperformers tended to use more value creation logics in their major adjacency moves. And even if you were not an outperformer, the more logic you had to some of these step outs, the better you also did. And so it's really important to think about, hey, don't just choose an adjacency, but know why you have a right to win.
So how do companies identify which adjacencies to pursue? Is it typically based on experience or team discussions? And what are some of the data sources and tools that can be helpful here? I'm curious specifically how you've helped your clients zero in on the right adjacencies.
I think we all know along the web, there is a variety of data around what types of trends are happening, new technologies, changes in preferences, but also thinking about what are similarities to certain businesses and capabilities that could be leveraged. And so we helped a software company recently think about new growth opportunities outside of their core using Gen AI, because they were really struggling in their core business with a lot of uncertainty and honestly a lot of competition, and they wanted to identify new diversification opportunities. And so what we did is we used these newer AI tools to actually scan the unlimited unstructured data of the web to identify over 500 different growth ideas using some of those value creation logics I just described. And that was a process that, as many of us who have used AI know, it takes a really good set of prompting, but it actually doesn't take a lot of time to execute. And then we were able to take those 500 ideas and do another set of AI-related analyses to prioritize them based on things we could see outside in around real trends, news mentions, momentum, and patent intensity to give the management team a short list of ideas for them to really look at. And then the last step to using Gen AI, of course, is you need to marry it with your human creativity and expertise. And so there was a little bit of work that this client chose to do with their senior management team to explore really what is the fit if they were to go after this. Who would be the talent that they would need to bring in? Is the market really big enough for them to take that kind of bold bet? And do they believe in the growth potential that AI was suggesting could be latent? And what's amazing is, one, these sets of ideas that the management team aligned on were ideas that they hadn't really talked about before. AI was generating new concepts for them to challenge their pre-existing beliefs. But then two, AI was enabling them to do this search far faster than historically they were able to do this. I think this example took about 1 week to run those AI analyses and have an initial workshop with the management team. So it's a really powerful tool to challenge some of the orthodoxies within your organization as you think about adjacencies and breakouts. Let me also give you an example in Nintendo. They may not have used AI, but a more could have been a traditional company thinking differently about how do they leverage some of their core advantages in their customer relationships. So I think many of us know Nintendo. And over the last 5 years, they really thought about how can they go beyond just the gaming systems to expand their shareholder performance. And so just a couple of examples of what they did, you know, in 2018, they thought about a new business model and the customer intimacy that they have with the Nintendo Switch Online that gave their fans access to a growing library of beloved titles at subscription prices, completely changing their revenue model away from one-time consoles. In 2021, they thought about, again, we know our customers well, but we also need to attract even new and younger individuals to our platforms and our assets that we know are beloved. And they opened an entire theme park, right, in Japan, Super Nintendo World, that gave a lot of individuals access to these older platforms and generated a ton of interest both in their core business, but then a whole new adjacent and breakout revenue stream. And then finally, I don't know if anyone watched it, but earlier this year, they actually went into non-software entertainment with their first foray into movies, delivering the Super Mario Brothers movies, which this year was the first film release to reach $1 billion in box office sales. And though we may say, hey, you know, it's a brand, they're just experimenting, these experiments into adjacencies and breakouts had tremendous impact on what had otherwise been a slower growth business. They grew revenues over 25% annually and delivered tremendous shareholder return, nearly 15% in this period.
Kate, that's a great example. I was wondering if you could comment, if possible, on what they did with their core while they were moving into the adjacencies you just described.
Yeah, I mean, clearly they still had a lot of their core platforms, as I mentioned, in their hardware sales and a number of game releases. And so, there are other companies in entertainment that do this as well, is thinking about how do we have corresponding launches of some core assets, so new Mario games or otherwise, that are well-timed, and the other sort of marketing engines that we have in our core business, how do we line up some of these release calendars so that we get that flywheel of someone sees our movie and is now very interested, and oh, there's a perfectly placed advertisement directing them to some of our core. So I believe they also saw tremendous increase in core business sales as a result of some of these adjacencies.
There was also a change in leadership there that preceded the changes that you described. So a follow-up question for you on this is, how does an incumbent leader or CEO really drive this move into adjacencies? And in your research, for the folks who actually choose growth, how much of that is associated necessarily with a leadership change versus a leadership renewal? In other words, how do you create that almost burning platform for the existing folks at a company to get really excited about choosing growth?
I mean, I think we do see that leadership changes, specifically CEO changes, often are associated with real moments of, I would say, just reassessing and reasserting strategy. A new CEO often comes with a fresh look at the business and the real hard truths around, is our core really performing? Have we missed kind of a big opportunity that our others see? And so I would say, yes, there's probably thousands of examples that with a senior leadership change is a new commitment to exploring, I would say, a bolder strategy or a more courageous choice. Also, often because the board has helped pick that CEO candidate because they are aligned with that boldness and courage at that time. That said, that doesn't mean that an incumbent can't also create that same moment of truth and burning platform with their boards, with their leadership teams. And there's different ways to do it. I would say some of the most successful executive teams I've had the privilege to work with did a very good job at understanding the market. We, you know, if you go back to the granularity of growth, 80% of your growth is also where you choose to play, and understanding if your core businesses are under attack. How do you articulate that issue with your teams, with your board, to come up with a strategy that lets you compete differently is super important and very effective. Because if people see that, hey, our core market is shrinking or is going to grow at GDP minus one, no, everyone recognizes that that's not going to be a good outcome for shareholders in the long term, given what we know about expectations of growth over the long term from investors.
So the one strategy that we haven't yet touched on is the concept of shrinking to grow. What exactly does that mean?
Yeah. Many of our clients feel pressure to deliver consistent growth. And It is good if you can get it, but we know only about 10% of companies in our sample were able to maintain positive growth rates across the decade. And that's the consistent growers that every single year you see revenue grow up. But suppose you don't have this consistent growth engine. Maybe your core business has a lot of existential threats or is dealing with some of the challenges that Jill mentioned as we started this conversation. We talk a lot about programmatic M&A with selective divestiture being one of the best approaches, as well as the riskiness of a large deal. I think we see this, again, more with a growth lens. And on selective divestiture, that is akin to what we're calling shrink to grow. What we see is the next best strategy after consistently growing is to periodically prune back your portfolio and then grow healthily from a new base. So in the data, this looks like a shrink to grow company divests parts of their business 1 or 2 years out of the decade, but in every other year, they grow consistently from that new base. And that's an amazing strategy. And we've seen it work in a lot of conglomerate examples, right, where they look at their portfolio more regularly and say, hey, these are less attractive parts of our portfolio. And what if we divest and reinvest those proceeds in new trends that we think are going to be a better platform for us? And that's when investors get and our companies are heavily rewarded.
Interesting. So as you're thinking about shrinking to grow, what if the businesses that you're looking at pruning actually have some real stars working in them? You know, we talked earlier about the importance of maybe moving a rock star like a CTO to help capture a new growth, an entirely new growth opportunity. How should companies be thinking about that talent dimension when they're thinking about shrinking to grow?
Yeah, well, so I think it's important, one, to always know your talent and to know if there is a rock star in a business that you are thinking about divesting. And then there's a balance. Obviously, when you do a divestiture, there are key man clauses that any acquirer will want to have business continuity. And so I do think there are steps you can take to understand which talent you would like to retain, but you have to be able to appropriately backfill them or create the right business continuity as you exit the business. So it is a balance. But the worst thing you can do is just sell the business and not think about the talent that's within it that you may need to retain because they could, you know, be the best technology officer for a new growth entity that you're going to reinvest in.
And if I may add, right, a lot of times when we think about acquisition, we talk about the concept of 1+1 = 2, right? I think when we think about divestitures or spinouts, you know, unless you're shutting down a business, right, I think we also think about, like, I don't know what how the math equation here is, but it, you know, it's not 2 - 1 = 1, right? It's actually 2 - 1 = 1.5, right? Because you actually want the idea is, you know, you're not the best owner of the business. Someone else might be or might flourish better on its own. So the idea is being separated not only gives you proceeds to reinvest and help you do better, but could actually help the other entity, right, also do better. And so I think that is the idea, if you will, around, you know, shrink to grow.
Yeah. And what we do see is separating these businesses allow each of them to focus more and invest accordingly related to their market's challenges. So maybe it is a slow growth business that you have divested, but now that management team is really well aligned around the challenges that that industry has and what investments they need to drive efficiency or new business models to make it live over time and grow profitably. That's really hard if that's in a bigger entity to make some of those trade-offs. Go ahead, Sean, though.
Thank you, Kate. So once you've laid out the various growth paths and developed strategies, you then need to execute them with an eye to transforming the company's growth engine. In your experience, what does excellence on this aspect of execution really look like?
Yeah. One of the timeless truths around transformation is that people are at the heart of really the success of the kind of change that we're talking about here when it relates to growth. And so you have the right aspiration, mindsets, and culture with clarity on what pathways. The most important next thing you need to do is to involve as many people as possible in the change around growth that you are trying to do. We think about that in a couple of ways. One is you do have to win the hearts and minds and equip people to do this work. And so we find that successful transformations are 8 times more likely to think about four dimensions of influence to activate their full organization. So that's thinking about getting everyone aligned to the aspiration, building skills that they're going to need to deliver growth, whether it is functional capabilities like marketing or financial analyses and portfolio changes. They also need to have their leaders talking about the change consistently, cascading it down, and then having real processes and accountability to say, are our bets working? Are they not? Can we move faster across our teams? So we see that being really important. And then in addition to all of that influence model, just the more people involved, the better. Those that fully implemented people measures, where over 20% of their employees were owning transformation initiatives, saw nearly twice the excess shareholder return of companies that did not involve as many people in this. And so it kind of goes back to where Joel started. Like, growth is a choice, and it's not just the choice of the CEO and their executive team. You actually need your full organization to also choose it to make it successful.
One follow-up question on the pursuit of adjacencies. Are there any failure modes for where they can go wrong, and how do you protect against them? Specifically, I was wondering, is there anything around the leadership aspects that are either a big positive or that can be challenging around this pursuit of adjacencies and how you get people aligned around them?
Yeah, I think a failure mode of some of these bigger adjacency moves are you enter into places because you see others entering them, but you don't actually have any right to win. I think that's probably the biggest one that we see is just because everyone else is doing it doesn't mean that you are the best owner. And so having a really thoughtful process to think about, why would we win? Are we bringing customers? Are we bringing capabilities? Do we have an exciting business model or technology idea? If none of those are true, the likelihood that you are going to win in that new adjacency is very low. And probably you're going to spend a lot of money or investment or people or time trying to get to that initial right to win. So I'd say that's probably the biggest failure mode I would caution against. And then as well, thinking about, are there ways to sequence your entry to test the waters a bit? We also talked a little bit about Big Bang M&A. That's a really expensive way to test out a new adjacency. Versus how do we think about perhaps programmatic M&A to acquire capabilities in smaller bites or building it internally with smaller investments with clear milestones to make sure that you're measuring the reward with the risk that you're taking.
Thank you, Kate. We've covered a lot of ground here. And now I just wanted to see if you had any final messages for our listeners. Kate, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I think for me, maybe it is also because of all the advances. We talked briefly about Gen AI, but also just frankly, industry disruption. I have seen many more management teams recognize that they can't just do what they've been doing and expect to grow or outperform. And so I think many teams are realizing this moment of truth that they have to innovate in their core. Just like Rebecca talked about, over 73% of groups are talking about core product innovation, which I think 5 years ago, that number would have been much lower. And they are thinking much more seriously about adjacencies and breakout growth because they recognize that someone may come after their core business that they didn't even expect 5 years ago. And so they almost always need to be making other bets because the markets are changing so quickly now. So it's just a really exciting time to be thinking about growth.
Thank you, Kate. Anything you'd like to add, Jill?
You know, I am excited and encouraged that across the companies that I speak to, despite the economic uncertainty and, you know, as Sean had said at the outset, largely in the financial services arena, there is not a company that I can point to that is not focused on growth. And so despite the backdrop that we're in, the idea of we need to keep growing, we need to continue to innovate is at the forefront. And I think that, you know, is particularly exciting. When I think back to other periods of economic uncertainty, the hunkering down, the fixation on the core only, the, you know, focused on effectiveness and efficiency has been much more at the forefront. And now growth remains a priority.
Thanks so much, Jill. Rebecca, you get the last word.
I was going to say, so well said by Jill and Kate. Maybe two thoughts I would leave. First is this idea around investable growth. I think we have seen a dialogue shift from, you know, just growth to really think about what is profitable. How do I think about self-funded growth? And then maybe the final thought is just courage. But really just having that courage to trust your strategies, to trust your gut, and to trust the path forward and the moves that you want to make.
Awesome. Rebecca, Kate, Jill, thank you so much for taking the time with us today. This was both a fun and informative conversation.
Thanks, Sean.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us today. We'd welcome your feedback and ideas for future podcasts. All you need to do is email us at itsr@mckinsey.com. Again, that stands for Inside the Strategy Room. You can also share your ratings and reviews on any podcast player, with many thanks to everyone who's already done so. We really appreciate all of your comments and feedback and hope you keep them coming. If you enjoyed today's episode and you'd like to subscribe, you can follow our weekly series on any podcast player. And that's where you can also access our entire library of previous episodes. We also offer an Inside the Strategy Room podcast collection page that's available at mckinsey.com/ITSR. And there you can easily browse our prior podcasts across six major themes and also access written transcripts of all of those conversations. Finally, if you'd like to automatically receive our latest publications and insights, we encourage you to sign up for email alerts on our insights page available at mckinsey.com, or you can follow us on X at MCK Strategy, or connect with us on LinkedIn at the McKinsey Strategy and Corporate Finance Practice page. Thanks again for listening. We look forward to having you join us again next week inside the Strategy Room.